Session number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel 17.
Lieutenant Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 17. Your last remarks, Colonel, your thoughts were beyond the Chinwin. What were those thoughts?
Many and varied. I was thinking of my chaps in Rangoon. We heard reports on the radio and pictures in the paper where the 2nd Battalion of the Durham Light Infantry had a detachment commanded by Captain Brian Selwyn, who were guarding the Japanese surrender plenipotentiary General Takazo Numata, Chief of Staff to Field Marshal Count Terauchi in Saigon, who had flown from Saigon to Mingled on Rangoon to negotiate the surrender. But when he arrived, he was so arrogant, he gave the impression that it was the British that were surrendering, and he was booted back to Saigon. And the next time he came back, he had his tail between his legs. And I think General Boy Browning would see his surrender and his sword, if not in Rangoon, certainly later on in Singapore. But they were accommodated in a house in Rangoon and guarded by Derhams under Brian Selwyn. My thoughts were also of the lads that had been killed and wounded in the battalion and in other units in the division. And I made a point of writing to various people to say that their brothers, sons, husbands were alive and well. I wrote to a Mrs. Evans in South Wales to say that her husband Ronnie, who had been on the same troop ship as I was, going to India in this fabulous Welsh choir on the Her Majesty's Transport Dilwara, he'd come out of Rangoon with us, with his ENSA troop, the entertainment organisation out of Rangoon. And I said, I'm going home, I'll let your wife know you're fit and well. I wrote to a nun in St. Anthony's Convent, Sunderland, to say that her brother, Warrant Officer Oswald Burke, was fit and well in Rangoon, and I'd known him when I was there in my officer cadet days, and several others either telephoned or dropped them a line. I mentioned the visit to Durham Cathedral and the regimental chapel with my old school friend, Miss Muriel Joan Mailing of Sunderland, who was a descendant of General Sir Henry Havelock. And before I set off for London and my journey back to the Far East, she gave me a very nice book called Listening for the Drums by General Sir Ian Hamilton. And A, I found it both interesting and amusing, and B, I learnt one particular point from it. General Hamilton referred to the fact that Field Marshal Lord Roberts, who had spent 41 years in India, knew the names of most of the British Tommies and Indian sepoys. And if he didn't know the name, he could remember where he'd met them before. And this was a big factor in his man management and the respect and popularity in the previous century. And I've made a point of following that ever since. In passing, General Ian Hamilton remarked that Kitchener would ignore people. However, I'm very grateful to Muriel Mailing for this book, from which I learnt one point of officer qualities and man management.
Were there any other things in Rangoon towards the end of the, or after the end of the war, that come to mind?
Yes, one important event occurred, which I overlooked on our last interview, and that was, of course, the victory parade through Rangoon. And we did one rehearsal parading Army, Navy and Royal Air Force on a padang, which is a large open space, a sort of grassy sports arena type area in the sort of centre north of the city, and then preceded by a Royal Navy, an Army and a Royal Air Force Guard of Honour, the 2nd Battalion of the Durham Light Infantry marched past complete as the representative battalion of the 9 battalions in the 2nd British Infantry Division. After the rehearsal, of course, the day came for the big thing the following day. And as we were falling in and parading, a group of 5 or 6 Royal Navy officers happened to be walking past. They were dressed absolutely immaculate in the Royal Navy caps, with white edging, starched white shirts and shorts, white stockings, white shoes, which contrasted somewhat unfavourably to our jungle green. And of course there were great hoots of derision and laughter from our troops at these 5 spick and span Royal Navy officers who obviously come off one of the warships in the harbour. They had obviously done their stuff in their own way at sea in the Indian Ocean and probably the Atlantic, the Mediterranean, the Pacific before, but our jungle wallers did a certain amount of mickey taking and got amusement from it, and they were fair game. Lord Louis Mountbatten, our Supreme Commander-in-Chief, Southeast Asia Command, Supreme Allied Commander, commenced his opening address, but within 3 minutes the heavens opened, the monsoon rains, and it bucketed down for the rest of the morning. The Guards of Honour were drawn up in front of the saluting base, to which Lord Louis Mountbatten went down by jeep, one of his favourite means of transport, and the Army Guard of Honour was actually provided by 1st Battalion of the Royal Berkshire Regiment and commanded by the 2nd-in-command, Major Frankie Boschel, who had by this time recovered from the severe wound he received on or about the 23rd of December 1944 in our first bump with the Japs in the Wangyo Gorge in central Burma, when he and his commanding officer Colonel Robinson were wounded and Major Huntley Wright of the 3rd Carbineers killed, and then Lieutenant Don Good of the Royal Engineers wounded, dragging them out. The battalion marched very proudly through the streets of Rangoon, despite the bucketing rain, and I've seen it several times subsequently on Movie Tone News or Gaumont British, whatever, and owing to the distance in which it was filmed and the short time it's on the screen, I haven't yet been able to identify anyone in the battalion, although where it played slowly, I have no doubt that I and others could identify the chaps in the march past, possibly even ourselves. Another thought that came to mind was when we rescued the nuns from Zorgi Convent and took them back to get them back into Mandalay, we were asking them how long they had served out in Burma in the mission field. And the nun with the least number of years service in Burma, continuous service, was a Sister Aquinas, who I mentioned earlier in an earlier interview, and she had done 18 years continuous service in Burma. This, of course, made our lads think, because some of them, half the battalion probably, were now approaching the 4-year mark and were naturally all ready for home. But it certainly made them stop and think and count themselves lucky. And it reinforces what I said earlier, that the nuns had stayed there for 3 years of occupation by faith, but had spent 18 and 30 years in the mission field, fortified by their faith and their vocation.
Did you find that, in general terms, that religion had any influence upon the men and their ability to withstand the privations and the dangers?
I think there's no doubt in my mind that each person had his own link with whatever he believed in and whatever to whatever denomination he belonged. We had a Church of England padre in the battalion who was not the most popular of padres or officers and had a most unfortunate manner. Going back to a few weeks to the occasion when Lieutenant Connolly dislocated his spine or broke his neck diving off the Z-craft into the shallow water of Ramry Island, the padre unwisely said that Con would die, and this made him very unpopular with our brother officers.
Were there other religious denominations?
The brigade headquarters, we had a good padre who I bumped into on occasions, and he seemed to be always dressed for war, including his 3/8 revolver, and that was Father Slattery. And he was the brigade padre administering to the Roman Catholics in the three battalions, the Royal Welsh, the Royal Berkshires, and the Durhams.
Other non-combat elements, Colonel, what were your memories or recollections of those? I'm thinking particularly of RAMC, MPs, what have you, lines of communication.
I never actually saw the RMPs in Burma. But the Royal Army Medical Corps always have been and always will be the salt of the earth. Our own battalion stretcher bearers were excellent within our company, C Company of 2DLI. Corporal Campbell was far from the age of a chicken, but kept going manfully, nor was he the right size and shape for climbing cuds, which is the local word for hills. But he always battled on manfully. One of his stretcher bearers, Private Farrer, was from near where I came from, Middle Herrington. Farrer was from Silksworth, and I was pleased to bump into him on occasions after the war when he became a bus conductor with the Sunderland District Omnibus Company. And Corporal Campbell, Farrer, Pridmore, and a couple of others were our company stretcher bearers. Our battalion medical officer was, again, salt of the earth, a very brave man indeed, Captain Teddy Havard Jones. He had, his armoured ambulance had been blown up by a mine during the Battle of Kohima, and he was always on hand dealing with the wounded and the shocked. I'm pleased to say that after 39 years, he contacted me again when doing local work, locum work, as a surgeon at Bishop Auckland Hospital. And he and Private McGrath and I met up again. And he came here, we entertained him at my home, and he entertained McGrath and I out for a meal at one of our locals. And I'm still in touch with Teddy each Christmas.
Have you any recollections and memories of men who broke in the sense that they attempted to shoot themselves or to run off? Or?
Yes. We had a number of cases of shock, self-inflicted wound, and, for want of a better word, cowardice. Some people take less than others, and some people could take more than others. Going back again to the first contact we had coming through the Wangyo Gorge, when Lieutenant Kit Corner sorted out the Japanese half-section position and bagged a couple of them. One chap, who was full of talk, got evacuated, ostensibly with a twisted knee. A private Blow by name and Blow by nature. I should always remember one of his platoons saying, "There was nowt wrong with him, sir. It was just the wind of the bullets." Then at the Parga crossing of the Sipadon Chong, when Lieutenant Len Bedell was mown down, leading his section across, a Private Smith from that D Company platoon went to pieces. I can recall seeing him huddled with a blanket round him in a Bren gun carrier. But it had its amusing side. One chap had got a broken leg, having been hit by a bullet, and was travelling in Captain Havert Jones' Jeep ambulance. And after the war, when I met my own Private Pound, who was wounded in the shoulder, as I recounted earlier, on the at Tong Yong, he told me that whenever the Jeep ambulance stopped, a whistle blew and the wounded were to debus rather smartly and swiftly before they got wounded or again or killed. But Pound said that the chap with the bullet through the leg and the broken leg could run as well as anybody. And it just shows that fear does give one wings. In the Irrawaddy Bridgehead, Private Broughton from my platoon went to pieces overnight and was slumped at the bottom of his pit saying, "I can't stand it, I can't stand it." He had a lot of home trouble, West Hartlepool, unfaithful wife on at least two occasions, and he was evacuated as medically unfit and not able to take any more. As we approached Tong Yong on the 30th of December 1944, a Private Rainey from Newcastle was in a hell of a state. He was a great big fat slob, and one would have thought capable of a better performance. But he eventually again was phased out of the company in the battalion. Prior to our second attack on Tong Yong, which never got across the start line, a Private Tryance in another platoon went to pieces. I think I mentioned he'd had his head shaved to look operational, and he was screaming and crying and wailing and shouting, and he gave the appearance of a skull that was crying. When we, in the Irrawaddy Bridgehead, our second attack, having taken Sandy Ridge on the 27th of February 1945, we were lining up to, as a battalion attack on Zalokma, to follow up the strike by the four Hurricane squadrons and the heavy barrage of approximately 91 guns. A Company were moving up forward left, B Company forward right, and C Company were covering the left rear, D Company the right rear of this battalion set-piece attack, when suddenly, to our rear, a rifle shot rang out. We knew by the sound of the shot that it was one of our own rifles, the number one, the Enfield rifle, as opposed to the Jap high-pitched, sharper crack rifle. And my first reaction was, "Oh, bloody hell, they've got round behind us." Two or three minutes later, a second shot rang out. And again, it was one of our own, and not the Nips. And as we couldn't see any enemy, we hoped that they weren't behind us. But within a short while, we learned that it was Private Kerfoot from another platoon, shooting himself with a self-inflicted wound. So they are examples of a few examples of what we had, and then of course other people had even more hair-raising experiences. We got rid of the wounded chap, Private Smith, who jumped on top of my runner and flung his arms around me on Sandy Ridge, which I described in an earlier interview.
Were any men, the reaction so acute that they actually did commit suicide?
Sadly, I didn't encounter any of this in action, but sadly, in Rangoon, when we were involved with guard duties at the Insein jail, and while we were up in the Irrawaddy Delta, patrolling and taking part in holding and mopping up operations while the Japanese 28th Army was bottled up in the Pegu Yome, as we were covering the Delta area to the south of Pegu, one of our cooks, who was left behind at Mingledon, through the pressure of long service overseas and domestic problems back home, he sadly took his own life with a rifle. That is the only instance of actual suicide that I can recall.
Were you yourself involved as a platoon commander with your own men in this kind of difficulty where men were having problems at home and having to try to cope with them in the situation they were already in? Did you come across that to any extent?
You hadn't any time to be an agony aunt or a marriage counsellor. You were too busy getting on with the job and fighting. And all you could do was give it words of encouragement. But it was minimal, this type of thing. Broughton was the only domestic case in my platoon involving trouble at home. Sergeant Rushford had this ill, very ill, sick child who died before he got home on leave. My Lance Sergeant Wharton had lost his mother previously. Private Rahilly, I mentioned in the last interview, company clerk, his mother died in Liverpool. My father died. That was quite common. You just soldiered on. And there's plenty to take one's mind off home problems. You were too busy staying alive.
What, looking back over your service in Burma, Colonel, what was your opinion of the Japanese soldier?
The Japanese infantryman, the Japanese soldier, the Heitai, as he's called in Japanese, he's a good infantryman. But once we had them falling back from the Chinwin onto the Irrawaddy River line, they fought a stubborn type of rearguard action, but they were backpedaling. General Kinmura, the commander in Burma, overall commander in Burma itself, decided to fight along the line of the Irrawaddy shore, as he called it, where the Irrawaddy runs north to south, sweeps round a bend between Mandalay and Sagang, and proceeds westwards, and then swings right round the bend westwards between Mandalay City and Sagang on the west bank, and then it ran westwards. Our bridgehead was roughly in the middle of this westward line at Nagazun, and then it swung left-handed to run north-south again from Minmu southwards and past Bakoku, where 4th Corps crossed at the same time as 33 Corps were crossing in the Mandalay area. And we found them very good defensive fighters and very, very brave in the assault. But we were beginning to get on top of them through air attack and our tank support, because we were out of the jungle. Admittedly, the villages had a lot of trees around them, and palm trees and banana trees, and in scrub country, they were difficult to get out, and that is why even on Sandy Ridge it was more of a one-for-one basis. They plugged one of my men and we plugged one of theirs. The only thing that, from what I heard, the Japanese feared most, we had flamethrowers once, the Wasp mounted a Bren carrier in support of us, but didn't need them. But that flamethrowers was the one thing that the Japanese did not like, and if they got the chance, would run. But determined, just as I recounted in an earlier interview, rather than risk capture, this officer shot himself after Riddle had riddled one of his men who, when they blundered into our position astride the Mandalay Rangoon Road, and the two chaps that, having been fired at by Beaumont and his colleague from B Company, jumped off their bikes. One would fall off because the burst of Bren shattered the front wheel on the bike. They couldn't pile into Bowman, and his colleague quick enough. And fortunately, our lads won the hand-to-hand contest. So we found that they were a very, very brave and stubborn enemy. Having said that, when they became stragglers and separated from the units, they just seemed to wander. They knew the general line of withdrawal. We would say retreat. They didn't like to use the word, but they tended to be a bit gormless and out of touch when on their own, with no NCO or officer to command them. Then again, if told to stay in a hole and fight to a finish, they would. I think General Biddle Slim once said on occasions, only one army fights to the last man and the last round, and that is the Japanese army. So that's a pretty good recommendation.
You referred to earlier, Colonel, that on coming back to England, that you may have had some ear trouble. Did this continue?
No, that was just a chance remark, as an officer and I were walking along a corridor at Luton Hoo. He was taking me to Colonel Fillingham's office at this Army Resettlement Formation College in Sir Harold Verner's mansion at Luton Hoo. And he turned to me and said, were you deafened in Burma? I said, no. Why, do you ask? And he said, well, I've been talking to you for the last couple of minutes. You haven't heard a word. And it crossed my mind that when I was blown off my feet on Sandy Ridge, it might have affected my eardrums. But being 20 years of age, not quite 20 years of age at that time, still 19 years young, I thought nothing of it, never gave it a passing thought.
Coming back to your leave, did you find it in any way difficult settling into a leave situation over quite a long period, 4 weeks, whatever it was, after having had a rather difficult and hard ship of war in the jungle?
No, there was plenty to do, plenty of people to see, as I said, contacting colleagues, relatives, and my visit to the regimental chapel in Durham Cathedral. It was good to be alive, and there was a general tremendous air of happiness and relief throughout the country, and a great bond of comradeship between we servicemen. Having said that, one looked at those who had dodged the column, whether in reserved occupations or plain Commodore Garden conscious, we looked at them with a certain amount of contempt. I had a certain amount of contempt even for my elder brother, who had stayed at home on the farm and just worked when he felt like it, instead of joining up. My second brother, on the other hand, had worked very, very hard indeed, and had been in the local defence volunteers and then the Home Guard. My elder brother had even had to be conscripted to the Home Guard. So there was a certain amount of personal loathing and contempt for that individual. And, of course, there are a few others who come to mind.
Was this a prevalent kind of response to people coming home and seeing those that hadn't gone?
I think everyone had their own views. And I personally didn't drink at that time, but when one or two people had a few drinks, they told a few people a few home truths.